January, hopefully, I'll be able to do a test run, a pilot run, and then an actual full survey in these three different ethnic regions. And that will be the main feature of my dissertation project.
Okay, all right. Looks like you've got, you're quite well on your way for the dissertation research, so that's good. We are going to just keep going, and then, so if you have questions, then just keep them in your mind, and don't forget, we'll get back to each one. So, the next person, I think we're going to Shweta. Hello, Shweta? Oh. Shweta. Maybe the internet went off there. Okay. Call dropped. Okay. We didn't see that message.
Sorry, just take a moment.
If you see the map and see where Majuli is, you understand maybe some problems with connectivity over there. She's literally out in very far off place, isolated.
So maybe
is there a way to send? Yeah, we'll go live. Can you send a WhatsApp message? That usually when all else fails. All right, then we'll move into Itchia, who has a slide presentation, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay.
Hi, everyone. I guess I'd like to start off by thanking the Sigur Center for this opportunity and making my experiences richer as a doctoral student. As you can see, I spent the summer scoping technology-enabled public health projects in Nepal, and I guess you can see my note. Could we maybe get it in presenter view? There are some notes in there that maybe I want to reference.
So it's just going to mirror whatever's on the screen.
Ah, okay.
So whatever you see, everyone will see.
Okay, well, I'll try to get along. So this is a real picture from Nepal. So, you know, in the context of scoping technology, that gives you an idea of what we're working with, in a sense. So some background here to set the stage for our conversation.
Those are cables?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
We're, I think, moving towards getting them underground. and it looks beautiful, the temples, if you can ignore the wires. Okay. So from a governance perspective, I don't know how much you know about Nepal, but we've been through a lot of turmoil in the past couple of decades. We've had a civil war. But prior to that, we moved towards democracy. And, you know, there's been a change of government every so often. And so there hasn't been any kind of stability in the governance space. And why does that matter for health? I'll get into that a little bit later. But we have, as good news, made some steady progress in the overall health outcomes in Nepal. After the MDG declaration in 1990s, we've, I think, made anywhere from 40 to 60% improvement in neonatal mortality, maternal mortality, and also immunizations, from what I can remember. So, you know, those are quite an accomplishment for a country, you know, marred with turmoil and instability. And despite all that, we've drafted some health sector strategies to prioritize our, you know, goals for the next 5 years or so, actually 2 years now. My timeline, sense of timeline sometimes is, you know, sometimes I feel like I'm in 2009, sometimes I feel like I'm in 2020 in the future. But We are, though, hoping to prioritize information and communication technologies. I think it's the right time to be doing it, given the massive, diffusion of information and technology throughout the world. Along that, we've also set some strategies around e-health, and that happened in 2017. And the vision is to facilitate kind of equitable and high-quality healthcare services. And the government of Nepal right now is a five-year government, which gives us a really stable time period. And they have a socialist inclination as well. So, you know, we're trying to set forth a lot of priorities and agenda and work towards something really, impactful, hopefully. Along these same lines, almost in parallel, infrastructure-wise, Nepal is also going rapidly improving in the ICT environment, the infrastructure for it, and enhanced mobile and internet connectivity. I couldn't remember the statistics now, but I think in 1995, we only had 50 people on the internet. I don't know how that compares to the US or anywhere else in the world, but just 50 people, and I think now we have more cell phones than the entire country of, the entire population of Nepal. And there's about, I think, 50 to 60% internet penetration. So, hey, if you want to go hike Mount Everest, until the base camp, I think you will have solid internet connection. And it's in that sense, it's really a good time to be setting out to engage in projects, public health projects for me, and using ICTs. And however, in doing just a cursory Google search, what was very evident is that there's a lack of documentation and evidence around what's happening around in the country, on the ground, who's involved in it, why are they doing it, who's funding it, for what ends, and what is sort of the big picture vision. And in these strategies that we've set forth, we say that we want to do this in a collaborative manner, because we cannot do it in any other way. We need the technocrats, we need the government officials, we need the funders, and we need them all in the same room talking to each other about how to move it forward. And it's a big goal. I completely recognize that, but it's also a necessary goal. And so that was kind of the impetus for me to go on the ground and do some digging. What informed us also is a similar study that was done in Bangladesh a couple of years ago, and it's interesting how my findings contrast to their findings, and it might, the question is why they differ and for what reasons. The purpose for my project, which I tried to outline just now, is just to map, and by map I do not mean geospatially, just map in an information sense. Any technology-enabled public health projects in Nepal, mainly that means mobile health or e-health. In doing so, we also try to understand what is their sense of understanding and definition for mobile health and e-health. We do not have, perhaps, a consistent definition for what those things mean, and they might differ based on sectors, right? And we try to do so in the context of the WHO health systems framework. There is such a thing where, you look at the governance aspect of these projects, the funding, the workforce, and try to, align them and see where each domain kind of falls within these projects. In addition to this, I think it's also very important to identify sort of key informants in the space, the thought leaders, the people doing the work on the ground, the people funding these projects, and what is their vision? What are they feeling? How are they, what are their experiences, some barriers, some lessons learned? What would they like for to happen? And, how can we meet what their visions are, and who needs to be involved at the table. Our methods, as I said, is we conducted a scoping review. We had 33 articles, and we used some specific keywords to get to them. We only focused on gray literature because, as I said, even gray literature was really scant. Forget, you know, actually peer-reviewed articles. And that's a real tragedy because without building this evidence base, I don't think we can move forward in an informed sense. And for a country like Nepal, I think it's a really important time to be, you know, informed with data and evidence. So hopefully this is, you know, this is going to move us in that direction. And like I said, we assess them according to the WHO health systems framework. Following that, we've conducted key informant interviews. These were semi-structured interviews, and we got an initial list of key informants through the scoping review documents that we, you know, pulled from the internet. And then from then on, it was kind of snowball sampling. And what I mean by that is one person said, hey, you need to talk to this person because they would be informed about this. And, you know, you need to get their perspective. And so here are kind of my preliminary findings. Technology-enabled public health projects are in a nascent stage in Nepal, and they're very frayed. What I mean by that is that there are multiple individuals conducting projects in their own individual organizations. There's no one really at the larger level saying, here's all the projects that are happening in Nepal, here's where the data is going, here's why the data is being collected. Of course, we have an ethical review committee, and all of these applications need to go through that, but they're not necessarily collating that information and informing and using that to inform anyone at the strategic level. And so there is a real need for a cross-sector kind of committee that, you know, that could be maybe independent from any government that is on the ground in Nepal right now, to be armed with this information. And there needs to be active monitoring, really frankly, about what these projects are doing. And the reason I say that is because without oversight, and this word wasn't taken very well by some of my key informants, but you know, without a bird's eye view and coordination and integration at the local and national level, I think it would be very hard to move forward in finding what these key ingredients are for successful mHealth or eHealth projects in Nepal. And if we have pilot studies that are happening and that they are being scaled at the organizational level, then without the government, and I think the government is the right entity to take ownership of this, at least at, you know, leading the helm. I don't think the government should be the sole entity on the table, but they should be kind of, you know, convening everyone that's in the space. I don't think we would have, we would be able to address some of the things that are, you know, becoming a concern now. For example, data security. So one of the key informants I talked to mentioned how his project failed. His project was centered around immunization in Nepal, and part of the project was to get fingerprints as a form of, you know, a unique identifier for children and individuals in the villages. And the villagers just turned them down. They said, no way, this is, you know, our legal identity. We do not want it to be compromised. We don't know what you're going to do with our fingerprints and how you're going to use them. And I think that's interesting in the context of what's happening in India with Aadhaar and, you know, data security. For those of you who don't know, Aadhaar is kind of the digital national identity system in India, and I think they've used fingerprints as one of their unique identifiers, and there have been some data breaches associated with that. So some real concerns that are producing there, you know, that are coming up there. And I was frankly a little proud of these villagers because the sense of awareness that our data is our data, and or even the question of who owns data, is a global conversation at this point. And so for uneducated villagers in a remote area of Nepal to be thinking along these lines, I'm frankly proud of them. But also, I think to your point about what you were saying earlier, this concept of trust And developing trust also applies to ICTs in a major sense. And so I don't think it's the role of perhaps funders or INGOs to be developing this trust. There needs to be some kind of a national system at multiple ecological levels. And what I mean by that is, you know, ICTs and public health happens at the individual level, at the interpersonal level, which is families and, you know, and friends and your social circle, and then at the organizational level, the hospitals you visit. So, you know, it's happening all around us. And so if someone, hopefully the government, will think about it in this sense and develop a model for how the national data and digital health system of Nepal should be developed, with the perspective that these frontline workers with three cell phones funded by three different organizations do not have to have three different cell phones. Perhaps there can be one app that can feed into the system, and the individuals doing these projects can work with the government to pilot their projects through the existing digital health system. What I am talking about is very kumbaya and utopian and really out there, but I think someone needs to set a vision for this. So that's one aspect of what I kind of, you know, what we've kind of found out of this project. Outside of that, there's also limited discussion of sustainability. Of course, how can it be sustainable if no one's thinking about, you know, anything beyond a pilot and short-term studies? Again, who's to, you know, absorb these projects and take ownership for them? It again requires some level of coordination and integration on some level, right? And without a successful pilot or without the ingredients for what makes a successful pilot through multi-site studies, this still is impossible. And sadly, there was limited role from the Nepalese Ministry of Health. It was hard to get them to talk to us as well. I did not end up getting a representative. I had a few people lined up, but it just did not happen. So, you know, that mirrors kind of our findings. So it's not, frankly, surprising, but it's still, I really wished I could have spoken to someone presenting a government perspective. The scope of the projects that I saw were really limited to rural and maternal and child health, which is a real reflection of who's funding the studies, right? And their interests lie in promoting rural and maternal and child health. But I saw many untapped areas of opportunity. For example, palliative care. A reputed doctor that I spoke to, who's working in this space, mentioned how he's using ICTs to provide palliative care to his patients. He does not have the time to go to multiple hospitals. And part of the issue is also that Nepal has a lot of migration happening, and all the working age individuals are moving to other countries, and what's left is either the aging folks or the children. So most of them aren't home to be able to take care of their parents. So he said, you know, the children are worried and so are the parents, and ICTs present a real opportunity for how we can move forward with taking care of the aging population in Nepal. Migrant health, I also had another key informant share that for all the migrants in Nepal that are moving to other countries where they do not speak the language, they do not have the most favorable health environment, they have access issues to health systems or transportation, are texting him, are Skyping him, and are seeking health information from him. And there is no regulatory framework right now that addresses, you know, that limits him from providing this care, but he still, for his own sake, provides a disclaimer saying this is not real, you know, medical counsel, but I cannot, you know, deny you care because my medical oath prohibits me from doing that. So, you know, there's an opportunity there as well. Urban health, chronic diseases. I mean, the list is endless. I just don't understand why ICTs are being limited to one sector or, you know, by sector, I mean one geographic sense or one health topic. So this is something to be explored further, hopefully. That's all I have for y'all today.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I mean, we've had a very wide-ranging set of proposals that we've heard from. And we have about 20 minutes, minus if Shweta comes back in. But so, you know, this is going to be sort of free-flowing. But if you have questions for any individuals, please direct it to them, and also identify yourself before you ask a question. But I want to start off, if I may, by asking one question to both of you. Shangtian, one of the things that it was interesting about your presentation is that the conventional argument of guerrilla warfare is something that one would, you know, that's what one hears about, and they've used it across the board, and it seemed to have been very effective in many cases. So are these conventional campaigns somehow unique and limited and specific to that to particular campaigns? And so how important are they, or do they really change the way we should be looking at military strategy? And so so that'd be one. And then the, you know, one of the things is that guerrilla warfare, one main thing is support of the people. And so you point out that would be a critical thing that would, versus the KMT versus CCP, for example. So it seems like there's some natural advantages. And Jangkar, you mentioned the way in which these groups identify with the state or not. And you focus on the interactions, on the ground interactions. What about the sort of bigger identity questions and the way in which the state is using discourse like, say, pluralism or diversity? So, for instance, at least in India, which is extremely diverse, one thing that they've done is the national motto is unity in diversity. So there are huge numbers of minority groups, but it's at the symbolic level. It seems to me sometimes that's actually even perhaps could be more important than what's happening day to day. But okay, so maybe it's...
Hi, Shweta, are you there?
Yes, hello.
All right.
So maybe just
hold on to the questions. We thought we had lost you, Shweta, but welcome back.
Thank you.
So why don't we get going quickly? We've got, if you could maybe, you know, about 10 minutes, if you could give your presentation.
Yes, so I was going to start with a short introduction to my field site. I also took my master's for something that could be revolutionary.
Shweta, hang on for one second. Is there any way to shift the mic or anything that you're using? The computer perhaps? Because we're hearing it very kind of squeaky and not very clear. It could be the internet. Oh, you know, I think it's really weak. I think the internet connection is really weak and we can barely understand what you're saying. It's struggling over here, let me put it that way, to get through.
Oh, that's too bad. I can hear you very nicely. So,
Yeah. No, you come in and then you're gone. So we're missing parts of it.
Should I call you back?
All right, let's try one more time then.
Okay.
Okay, maybe at least there's some connection there. Sometimes you just need the right connection. Oh, I like the starting sound of that. Shweta?
Yes.
Okay. Why don't you start a little bit? Not really, unfortunately. It's sort of like zinging in and out a bit.
Well, if it's easier for people, I can help
them. Ooh. Now it's even worse than before. Ah. Is there any other way to get it through a phone? WhatsApp call?
Yeah, if you have any, like a WhatsApp, a WhatsApp or a line or WeChat.
WhatsApp telephone? Oh. Okay, can't really understand that.
I'm just going to hang up here. I'll chat with you.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll keep going and hopefully you can join us, Shweta. Richard is going to get in touch by another means. All right. Okay. Back to the two questions and then we'll.
Okay, so question about the importance of conventional warfare in understanding the CCP's military strategy against Japan. So by arguing the importance of conventional warfare, I did not downplay the importance of guerrilla warfare for the CCP. But I think the argument here is that first, in order to understand the CCP strategy, we need to look at the local level. And at the local level, the commander has a lot of freedom to choose which strategy he wants to apply at a particular time period, at a particular place. And I think the larger significance of this argument is that first, if you look at the CCP's military history, so after the Sino-Japanese War, it fought a civil war almost immediately with the nationalists. And without conventional capability that it sustained or even built up in the Sino-Japanese War period, how could it survive the big battles with the nationalists immediately after Sino-Japanese War? So from the point of view of the continuous history from 37 to 49, it's important to understand how did the CCP have this, sustain this conventional capability. And I think the, another significance of the conventional argument is that it's important to not only understand the CCP's military strategy as using Chinese local conditions, mobilize the peasants, popular support, and so forth. It is also important to understand the CCP's military strategy from the view of modern conventional battles. Mm. It's very clear that during the Korean War, if you look at the Korean War, the CCP was very good at conducting these modern conventional battles. And how do they develop this capability? It has to be come from somewhere. And in order to understand this, it's very important to not only just look at the mobilizing peasants, popular support, guerrilla warfare, this argument. The conventional modern battle is also important, but I do not mean to downplay the guerrilla part. And if in the end, we may very probably see that the CCP very effectively combined these two together. And how they able to do that is a very interesting question. However, the present historiography, especially for the Sino-Japanese War, seriously downplayed the conventional part, which is problematic. So I think that's the largest significance of this study. And even for the Civil War period, so the argument often goes is about popular support, mobilizing the peasants. Mm-hmm. So the CCP simply overwhelmed the nationalists by numbers. However, probably the story is more complex, and as we see from the KMT's army records, the KMT themselves acknowledged that the CCP was very good at conventional battles.
Okay, so, thanks.
Yeah. Okay, so the question was, could it be that it's the national level symbolism and rhetoric, right? So the way I was thinking about it was, the way that ethnic minorities are treated, right, in Burma, the indigenous ones at least, the Chen Kyakar and Chen Monrakhang Shan, these are considered officially recognized as ethnic nationalities, like official ethnic nationalities. So these are treated somewhat differently from, say, you know, other ethnic minorities like the Rohingyas, right? So like there is this disparity between how ethnic minorities are treated. But within these groups that are considered indigenous, right, the groups that I'm talking about, as far as I know, like there isn't that much different in how, like officially, you know, with the state policy they're being treated. So if there isn't difference between, because there is symbolism and rhetoric happening between ethnic minorities, but not just among these indigenous, right? Mm-hmm. So if there's no really difference in how these indigenous are being treated at the national level, then we shouldn't see the difference level of identification between these groups, right? So why should the Gitchins feel so much lower attachment than, say, Chins, because these are both indigenous. Mm. I mean, I can see why, say, Rohingyas would feel so differently, right, compared to these indigenous, but if we just look at these indigenous, you know, like the national level sort of symbolism and rhetoric doesn't seem to do the justice in how these